This is the 6th, I suppose. April 6th. We'll look back a little bit at March, which was a very important month in a lot of different ways, and we'll look forward to April, which is shaping up as another important month, but in a different way. March was very important. Those of you who got the edition of BDS Monitor will know that all the major U.S. presidential candidates appeared, with the exception of Bernie Sanders, appeared at AIPAC, at the policy conference in Washington 2 weeks ago now. And all of them, in the course of their presentations to the crowd of some 19,000 people, made explicit statements against BDS. And in other comments that he made at the same time, Bernie Sanders also came out making a statement against BDS. All of the candidates emphasize the anti-Semitic nature of BDS. Ted Cruz also went a little further and declared that among his other campaign promises, he would endeavor to in effect make it illegal for universities to boycott Israel in any way. The relevance of these statements is pretty obvious. It suggests that, well, it lays down a marker by presidential candidates on the subject. And this is something that has been rather equivocal from the Obama administration until relatively recently. Also, last month, at a BDS related conference in Israel, the American ambassador to Israel made a statement on behalf of the president, declaring the administration's opposition to BDS, which was one of the most explicit policy statements by this administration. It comes rather late in the day for the Obama administration, but it's of course welcome nonetheless. All of these statements taken together indicate that the political echelon in the United States, the current one and the future one, whichever one that will be, feel it necessary to take the issue of BDS seriously, or express that they're taking the issue seriously. It's obviously way too early to say who's going to do what and follow through at the political level. But the message seems to have reached a series of politicians that the Jewish community and the pro-Israel community generally take this quite seriously. Other political figures around the world have also spoken out against BDS in a variety of contexts. The British Justice Minister, the Swedish Foreign Minister, the German Foreign Minister, they've all made, within the last month, very explicit statements about opposing Israel boycotts. And coming from the European context, where BDS is not simply defined by opposition to Israel in the universities, but has real economic and political implications, and where economic boycotts in particular have real potential for consequences, these are very welcome statements. I think the way to interpret all of these statements from Europeans and also from Americans is that the connection between anti-Semitism and BDS has really become inescapable. And the the place to, that we see this the most clearly is the British Labour Party. And this is something that I wrote about a bit in last month's Monitor. There's a scandal that in the British Labour Party that began at the university level, where the president of the Oxford University Labour Party Club resigned and made a public statement condemning anti-Semitism within this university club. And the scandal then spread to Cambridge, Cambridge University, to York University, and it shined a light on the Labour Party as a whole. And it became clear at that point that the Labour Party, a number of Labour Party members, including members of Parliament, are more or less blatant anti-Semites of the old school. And this includes British and Scottish members and ethnic members of the Labour Party. So the connection between BDS and anti-Semitism is really quite out in the open in Britain. And it's becoming more clear everywhere else that you look. And I think this is all inevitable and in a sense all to the good, that the reality of BDS singling out Israel in a unique fashion and demonizing it in ways that are indistinguishable from classical anti-Semitism can't be disguised and can't be shoved under the rug any further. This connection is really quite fascinating from an academic level, and it suggests to me that for one thing, the BDS movement at various levels, institutionally and locally, at various academic institutions, is feeling pressure for the first time, real pressure. And when they feel pressure, they feel more, they are less inhibited. They are more extreme when they feel cornered. And a very nice example of this, actually, I ran across about 25 minutes ago. There was a debate apparently last night at the student government at Stanford University, and about some sort of anti-Semitism resolution that was being proposed. And I don't understand all the details yet, but here's what one of the senators, the student senators who is running for re-election, these are his comments about this anti-Semitism resolution. He says that the resolution says, "Jews controlling the media, economy, government, and other societal institutions is a fixture of anti-Semitism that we theoretically shouldn't challenge." I think that's kind of irresponsibly foraying into another politically contentious conversation. Questioning these potential power dynamics, I think, is not anti-Semitism. I think it's a very valid discussion. Now, on the one hand, this is a kid who is possibly just quite stupid. On the other hand, I think that this very casual use, or this very casual assumption, let's say, that Jews really do control the media, economy, and government, and other societal institutions, and so on, is a lot more common than we think. And certainly the anti-Semitism that has been stirred up or exposed during the course of this presidential campaign from all sides is suggesting that it's a phenomenon that has certainly not gone away in the American context at all. And the connection with BDS is very close. So let's look ahead a little bit to April. April is shaping up to be a very interesting, very significant month for BDS. There are BDS resolutions that have been proposed and will be voted on at the City University of New York, and the New York and at New York University among the graduate students at both institutions. And at the City University, the resolution apparently calls for an actual full boycott of Israel and Israeli institutions. And this is so extreme that it has been suggested by legal observers that the resolution may actually be setting up a lawsuit on the part of pro-BDS supporters to try and challenge anti-BDS supporters. So we'll have to see how that plays out. The American Anthropological Association is also having its vote. It's an online vote this month going on, debating, in effect, a full boycott of Israeli institutions on the part of the Anthropological Association itself. So Israeli institutions would not be allowed to advertise jobs or subscribe to American Anthropological Association publications. And it would also, in a understated or covert fashion, legitimize individual boycotts by individual faculty members and maybe even departments of Israeli academics and others. A BDS resolution was approved at the University of Edinburgh in Scotland the other day, and there was an extreme and utterly ridiculous incident connected with this, where one student who was an opponent of this BDS resolution raised her hand during the debate and was immediately accused of violating the safe space, so-called, of the conclave that what they were undertaking with with this arm motion, that the arm motion itself was somehow threatening to the safety and mental well-being of the other attendees. And this is obviously ridiculous and really quite stupid in its own way, but it also shows, I think, how all of these kinds of mentalities or rhetorical tropes are feeding into one another, that this idea of safety first and safe spaces on campus where children can retreat to in order to not be challenged in any way by opposing ideas. And we've seen this, of course, with all over American campuses, hysterical responses to the appearance in chalk of the word Trump on sidewalks has caused fainting spells apparently, and calls for safe spaces and the occupation of various campus rooms and buildings. And there's a student lounge at Harvard Law School that has been, quote, liberated and turned into a so-called safe space by opponents of the institution who accuse it of systematic racism. So it's not surprising that BDS proponents are using the same kind of rhetoric and the same kind of accusations. In the political sphere, there's also been some interesting developments so far this month in April related to BDS. Paul Ryan, the Speaker of the House, is in Israel, and he declared his strong opposition to BDS in an interview a day or two ago. What's equally interesting and I think equally significant is that in Britain, where BDS generally has a different and in some respects more developed kind of character, the British government has taken the step of removing funding from a non-governmental organization, NGO called War on Want, which has been a leading BDS supporter. Something on the order of £500,000 over the last couple of years given to this organization, which is one of the most virulent BDS organizations in Britain at the academic level and at the economic boycott level. So, and I haven't been able to drill down to the precise governmental rationale for this, but whether it's specifically an Israel-related decision or whether there are broader kinds of terror funding concerns that the government is expressing. Many NGOs in Britain are that deal with BDS, that deal with Middle Eastern affairs, are controlled by various Islamists, Sunnis via the Muslim Brotherhood or Shia, which are basically front groups for various Iranian factions. So this is a story that bears watching. At the same time, it's important to note that what NGOs generally worldwide are a major source of BDS activity, funding activity, and European NGOs and British NGOs, to an extent that is not appreciated in the US, are government funded. They're government funded either directly by individual governments, they're government funded via the European Union and its various development arms and human rights, so-called arms, or they're funded by church groups, which themselves are government funded. This speaks to the nature of charity broadly in the European setting, which is very much a government kind of socialized concern, as opposed to the way it works in the United States, where charities generally, NGOs generally, are very much more a private, personal concern. And that's where the money comes from. So the defunding of one BDS supporting NGO is interesting. It doesn't represent a pattern yet by any means, but we'll have to keep our eye on that for the future. So in academia in particular, April will be a very interesting month, very important month. And as the semester ends, let's say in early May, I expect that we'll have a few last gasps of campus activity. Apartheid week this year was more or less a damp squib, a big nothing at most campuses, with a few exceptions here and there where there were the usual kinds of speakers and theatrics. The focus has very much moved to student governments over the last couple of years, and that's where the action will be going forward. And these academic organizations and student groups are very important. So we're keeping our eye on that, and we'll have more to share in the next BDS Monitor in May, and also or at the end of April rather, and also in our next webinar. So with that, let me stop yakking and see if we can take some questions and be enlightening that way. So.
Great. Thank you, Alex, so much for everything as always. The floor is now open for questions. As I mentioned before, those of you online, you could hit the icon of the hand button, and I will call on you, and we can start taking questions. Those of you on the phone can send emails in to bdsmonitor@sbme.org, and we can go from there. The floor is now open. I will scroll down the names. Okay, Robert Gordon is our first question. Robert, can you hear us? Robert? We
You're
can't.
coming in very faint, I'm
Okay.
afraid.
Yeah, we can't hear you, Robert. I did unmute you. Can you speak louder, please? You're coming in still very, very faint.
Okay, can I see Carol Oberg raising her hand? Can we move on to her, and maybe Robert can email his question in?
Yeah, sure, no problem. Let me mute Robert. Let's go on to oh, she's on the phone, but David Nerritt is
Oh, okay.
okay. David, do you hear us? David? 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 David, can you hear us? Are you able to speak? Okay.
All right, I hear a ping. I don't know whether that's a message coming in from someone
That's
or.
Alan. One second. Let's try it
Okay.
again. Robert, can you hear us again? Robert? Robert, are you able to pose your question? Not much success here. I apologize. Robert, are you able to talk?
I can hear you, but I don't think you can hear me.
Oh, now we can hear you. Now
Now
we can.
we can hear
Oh,
you.
okay.
Please go ahead.
Okay. All right. Well, I have two questions. One, what do you have any thoughts on Alterman's op-ed in the New York Times, in which he downplays the extent of anti-Semitism on campus? And my second question is, are there any prospects of getting chancellors or presidents of universities to openly oppose sanctions or divestment against of Israel?
With regard to the first question, look, I think it's very difficult to quantify the extent of anti-Semitism on campus. I think it's more, far more prevalent than Eric Alterman seems to believe, and largely because it is correlated directly with other kinds of attitudes. It's not anti-Semitism of the far right. It's not white power. It's not extreme nationalism. It's exclusively, almost exclusively, let's say, I'll cover myself, associated with anti-Americanism, anti-imperialism, anti-colonialism, a variety of anti-Western kinds of ideologies, which are deeply rooted and naturalized within the universities, and and these are far from the idea of Jews having horns, or Jews using the blood of children for in when they bake matzah. But it is very much more connected with something that the far left and also the far right share, and that's the idea that Jews control the media, the economy, the government, the banks, other social institutions. So I think he's wrong. But again, the extent to which and anti-Semitism generally, until relatively recently, has been an unfashionable kind of prejudice to express in American society and particularly on campus. I think it is becoming more fashionable as Jews are associated with openly with white privilege and with the upper classes in America. And so the restraints are being systematically removed. With regard to opposition to BDS from presidents and chancellors, this is pretty much the case across the board. And everywhere that where a university administration or board of trustees has been pushed or queried or forced into the position of making some sort of statement, these entities have come out very much against BDS. So a good example, which I didn't talk about from March, is that you have the situation at Oberlin, which is a smaller liberal arts college, where there have been a series of anti-Semitic incidents, including the revelation, I suppose, that one tenure-track professor believes that it was the Jews or the Israelis who undertook the 9/11 attacks and who are the force behind ISIS. Now, this sort of paranoid, crazy talk is bad enough, and it and the general tenor on campus at Oberlin has gotten so bad that a group of 250 or so alums got together and released a public letter condemning the atmosphere as it has become, which forced the Oberlin president, who happens to be Jewish, to issue his own condemnations, and the Board of Trustees to issue its own condemnation of this particular faculty member. And the same sorts of things occur pretty much wherever university administrations are forced to do so. So the president of Vassar, there was a talk at Vassar by this, again, kind of paranoid, crazy faculty member at Rutgers, who gave a long rambling talk, apparently, in which she accused Israel, among other things, of murdering Palestinians and stealing their organs. And the university president was forced into a position of condemning the speech, but supporting the right of the speaker to speak it, but also emphasizing that the administration does not support BDS. So I think there are some contradictions. I mean, free speech is a contradiction in many respects, and that's not a legal kind of standpoint on my part. It's we have a situation where pro BDS speakers are in the position of being able to or having the right to make the most ludicrous and extreme and vile kinds of statements and allegations. And the university, what are the limits of the university in endorsing or supporting or giving a platform to these kinds of speakers and their speech? This is a political issue, it's a philosophical issue, it's a legal issue, and I don't claim to have the answers. But in a practical sense, when pushed, universities have expressed their opposition to BDS, and that's the important thing.
Thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you for that. Our next question is to Yaakov. Let me unmute Yaakov here. Yaakov, can you hear us? Yaakov?
Now I'm unmuted.
Okay, great. Yes, okay. We can. Okay. Go ahead, please.
So my question, and it's interesting, when I went to your website, learn more about this presentation, I was at the Alan Dershowitz presentation at University of Baltimore with Ken Lassen. And I was interested then, and I'm still interested in, you know, people are very happy to point out that this is anti-Semitic. I think there's a reluctance to associate it with traditional anti-Semitism. And I think I heard a little bit of that in your recent answer, where you said that you know, it's now becoming more fashionable and more open to be verbally anti-Semitic. If we go back to the 1930s, this is not new, and there's not really no difference. There's a lot of misconceptions that are generated when we don't look at the history of anti-Semitism and try to look at this as some new thing. And I tried to find the article as I was waiting for my chance to speak, but you guys got to me too quickly. But on the Allgemeine Journal, Andrew Pessin, Professor Andrew Pessin from Connecticut, pointed out that there was a wonderful talk given against BDS in which the speaker said, you know, it used to be about the individual Jew and now it's about the collective Jew. I said, has this person never heard of the Protocols of Elders of Zion? It's always been about the collective Jew. The blood libels were about the collective Jew, a secret Jewish council controlling that they knew that they would return to Israel if they murdered a child, a Christian child, every year. It was not originally about the matzahs at all. And so it boils down to this question: why do you think it is that people are so afraid to call it like it is and say, look, this is just traditional anti-Semitism? It is exactly what we heard in the 1800s and the 1700s and the 1000s, just with a new dressing on it, that the collective Jew is now, quote, Israel.
Well, I think that's a very valid point. You know, as somebody who's had the misfortune of watching the BDS movement fairly carefully for 10 or 15 years. I think, and also the campus climate for much, much longer than that. I think there is a change in the rhetoric. And I think that, you know, the anti-colonial rhetoric of the BDS movement that prevailed really until quite recently, that has a certain kind of independent logic, let's call it. But underlying it, or on top of it, you know, we can sort of sketch it out any which way. I think the uniquely Jewish aspect of opposition to Israel is becoming clearer and clearer and clearer. Whereas 2 years ago, even 2 years ago, you would see BDS rhetoric oriented towards human rights and the deprivation of Palestinian human rights by Israel. And opposition to Israel and advocacy of boycotts on the basis of Israel as a colonial settler colonial entity. Well, I think that's all well and good in a way, and it has a kind of independent logic, or a logic that is independent of classical anti-Semitism. But I think what we're seeing in the last year, certainly maybe 2 years or so, is the addition on top of these kinds of this BDS rhetoric of classical anti-Semitic tropes like Jews are privileged class, Jews are control the media and the banks, and that it's not simply opposition to nationalism.
So when you said earlier, you hear me? I'm sorry.
Yeah, please, go on.
You said something earlier about, I guess I wasn't sure when you were quoting the student and when you were saying the student was being dumb. Who was it who said we should not, that we should accept the idea of talking about Jewish control of the media and the banks as legit? I thought that was you.
No, that's the student who was speaking last night at Stanford University.
Okay, now I get it. Okay, because you were saying how clueless this student was about the past. I admit that one washed over me a little bit. I'm like, is he really arguing that way? No, you were saying the student was.
No, I apologize. I apologize for being obtuse in my formulation. I think the student is expressing these things, but where does the student get it from? That's the interesting question.
You know, you've
given
me
a 19 or a 20-year-old student have absorbed this kind of notion that Jews control the banks, Jews control the media, and so on.
The things that the Palestinians, the things that children, that the students on campus are saying and being presented with. Poisoning of Palestinian wells. That is directly from the Black Plague. It's not like that. There's it took no shortcuts. I mean, obviously, Israel is not interested in poisoning anybody's water supply anywhere in the world and has never been. Where do they get that from? It comes directly from the Black Plague. It is murderous anti-Semitism. It was used as an excuse to kill Jews then. It's an excuse to kill Jews now. You know, actually, you've done what you gave in your answer about the way things changed in the last 2 years. I mean, it surprised me. I didn't. Maybe that's why I awakened to it, because I was so sensitive to the anti-Semitic things that people had said, and knowing more about that history, that's why I got so much more interested in the BDS issue than I was 2 years ago. But also, are you familiar with Joshua Moravchik's turning David into Goliath?
Right.
Yes.
And his original book was described by many as going through all types of hoops in order to avoid calling it anti-Semitism. And in most, I actually discovered that the paperback version, which just came out, has a new introduction. I discovered this because I found a reference to it on Mosaic Magazine, which is on the web, and you can read Joshua Moravchik realizing and saying why I changed my mind about anti-Semitism. He tried, at the end of the whole book is devoted to trying to avoid the conclusion it's anti-Semitic. And over the last 2 years, he was forced to realize it. And I actually questioned him. I talked to him directly and I asked him, what was it, you know, that wasn't visible before? And he really didn't answer me. And I think you've given a much more credible, like I said, he didn't really give me any answer. And you're giving an answer that it's just become much more visible.
For sure. Well, Alex, I'm just trying to keep a sense of the time as well. So if
right,
we have
right. Let me just make one final comment about that. I think it's more visible because I think that inhibitions are being removed, in part because BDS has become an element in a larger suite of social movements visible on campus, from the far left, and that simply gives license to the removal of Jewish privilege, as it is sometimes called. So, well, let's try and take another question or two before.
Thank you, Yaakov, and we'll continue the conversation. Let me take one more question here, with our time. I see that Evan Balin has a question. Evan, can you hear us?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, good. Question is, to what extent is the BDS movement populated by Jews? To that extent, of course, the issue of being anti-Israel and anti-Semitic creates a contradiction for that particular population. Clearly, but the first question is, to what degree are Jews supporters of BDS in the United States? You could talk about it worldwide if you have that data.
That's a very important question. Jews in the BES movement are a minority, but they're a very, very important and influential minority. The group Jewish Voice for Peace in particular, which is only a dozen or so years old, represents itself as this large growing alternative movement, and it provides a kind of Jewish cover for BDS. There are a number, small number, of Jewish far-left philanthropists like Lynn Handelman and Medea Benjamin of Code Pink, who are extremely important funders of the BDS movement. It used to be, let's say 10 or 15 years ago, that Jews were very much a minority, and they're still a minority, but I would not say that they're influential. They're certainly not a major demographic. The demographic is largely Muslim Americans, Palestinian Americans, and others. But Jews serve an extremely important role as funders at the top and within the movement itself, socially, locally. They are they're the good Jews. They represent themselves as the good Jews, the ones who question, the ones who reject Israel, the ones who reject their upbringing and the narratives that they've had forced down their throats, so to speak. And these kinds of stories, and we had a great example of this in the New York Times earlier this week. They solicited six people to write on, is anti-Zionism anti-Semitism? And, the majority of them were disaffected Jews. And that kind of narrative, oh, we've seen the light, and that pardon the cuckoo clock in the background. that this kind of conversion narrative always plays well in the mainstream media like the New York Times, and also locally. Everybody certainly every young person has the impulse to reject their upbringing, their roots, their background, in order to fit into something else. And in this case, that something else is a self-conception of being a good, progressive from the far left. Now, from an historical point of view, this is no different at all from young Jewish socialists and communists of the 19th century or the 20th century who repudiated their Judaism, or who kept their Judaism but repudiated Zionism. There are all sorts of different combinations. And young university student Jews of the later 1960s, and who, in order to fit into the broader leftist movements, created a series of organizations that are the structural antecedents of Jewish Voice for Peace and the other smaller ones that are out there. So at one level, there's nothing new under the sun. At another level, that historical realization doesn't help us very much, because the Jewish claiming to be the good Jews, those who claim to be the good Jews are always voices that are given outsized or extra attention, regardless of their actual numbers and actual influence. And one of the ways that they gain extra influence is precisely through claiming that they've they've seen the light, and that they're persecuted, and that the community doesn't understand them, and that they're the good Jews. So it's a long term and persistent phenomenon, but it's an especially pernicious and damaging one. So
thank you. And thank you, Evan, for your question. Our time is unfortunately up, and I know that people, you know, obviously want to continue the conversation, and that's why we are here. We are more than happy to continue, and obviously through our next BDS monitor, which will be next month, and through everything else that we do, please email us, bdsmonitor@skme.org. Reach out to us. We are more than happy to deal with all of these conversations, and that's why we are here at large to deal with these topics. So I really want to thank everybody for taking the time to be with us this afternoon. I want to thank, of course, Alex Jaffe for taking the time to talk to us this afternoon. I'm Asaf Amorowski again, and we thank you both for all of you for being here, and we will continue the conversation. So thank you very much.
Thanks.